Okay, we will start now. Let me clear the chat here. Today is the last class of this semester. We're in the middle of, let's pull them up here, the middle of Rav Meir Simcha of Divinsk. Just a couple things before we start. I pulled up, because of our conversation last class, the genealogy of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Rav Menachem Mendel, the Tzemach Tzedek, has 14 children. One of them, his name is Baruch. He didn't become a Rebbe. We spoke about the different Rebbes among the children. He had a son, Mordechai. He had a son, Levi Yitzchak, and that's the father of Rav Menachem Mendel. So he is a direct descendant of the Tzemach Tzedek, but not through any of the other Rebbe lines. I had some conversation with one of the listeners about, and I'm going to get back to this in a little while, the different versions of the story we saw about the Chafetz Chaim and Rav Meir Simcha, and I was asked, are there other stories like that? And there are plenty of stories where you have, when I mean other stories, where there's confusion. There's loads of stories, including eyewitness stories, which are untrue. Let me give you an example of a very good one, which I'm going to give it to you because it deals with the Chafetz Chaim, but I could give you examples of this dealing with all sorts of rabbis. There's a scholar in Israel, a Chabavitch scholar, actually, name of Munshine, who has numerous posts on the internet. He has a site called Sturim. Well, it's not only his site, but he posts there. And he specializes in debunking various tales of great rabbis, including Hasidic tales, including Chabad tales. And that's his own movement. But here's one that's not there. And credit here goes to Nussan Kamenetsky in this book, Making of a Gadol. He mentions on page 673, he talks about in the book Or Elchanan, Elchanan Wasserman, who we're going to have classes on him, one of the great students of not just Rav Chaim Soloveitchik, but the Chafetz Chaim. He tells a story in the book Or Elchanan about the Chafetz Chaim's funeral and Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman, what he did at the funeral. The only problem is that Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman was not at this funeral. Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman was in London when this happened. And in the Kamenetsky points out that in the English edition of the book, it leaves out this story, which is told in the Hebrew version, which is repeated by many people, precisely because it's not true. Now, where does this story originate from? It originates from a Rabbi Asher Katzman, who was a student of Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman. At least we're told this in Or Elchanan. Now, maybe Asher Katzman is no longer alive. Maybe he would say, no, he never said that story. He misunderstood me. In which case, there's just a perfect example here of how these stories get confused. But as we have it in the book, there is a story by Rabbi Asher Katzman, who is one of the people who accompanied Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman to Radin for the funeral. Only problem being, as I just said, that Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman was not there. So why is this significant? Well, it's significant for a number of reasons, one of which is the authentic, quote, documented account of the famous Dibbuk story with the Chafetz, with Rabbi Elchanan Wasserman and the Chafetz Chaim comes from none other than Rabbi Asher Katzman. So if he's not reliable about the funeral, I don't know if we can rely on him when it comes to the famous Dibbuk story. Now, I have to say, however, though, that Rabbi Asher Katzman's son, Rabbi Eliezer Katzman, is a great scholar, not just a Talmud Chacham, an expert in Lithuanian Jewish history, and I know him, and I'm going to ask him this question one day, and I know, or at least I'm certain, he's going to tell me that there must be confusion in Or Elchanan, the Hebrew biography of Rabbi Elchanan. But be that as it may, here we have a story, an eyewitness, supposedly account of a story, and yes, it turns out to be false. I'll give you another example of this later today. Let's pick up where we left off. Where we left off is, I mentioned that Rav Meir Simcha was not a Zionist. However, he was a lover of Zion, that is, a lover of Eretz Yisrael, of Aliyah, and he was not known as an opponent of Zionism. As I mentioned, this is where we ended. There are numerous examples. You have books, you have little contracim, you have many newspaper type of articles where the opponents of Zionism were able to express themselves at great length, and they were only too happy to criticize Zionism. Yet you find nothing from Rameir Simchov-Devinsky in any of these books. By the same token, the pro-Zionist rabbis were only too happy and had plenty of opportunities to spread their vision. You do not find Rameir Simcha. So it does seem that he was in the middle. That is, a supporter of settlement in the land of Israel, but not an actual supporter of political Zionism, and not an opponent of Zionism. We have many rabbis who were in the middle, not sure one way or the other. The reason why everyone assumes that he was a Zionist, and maybe he was sympathetic to it, but he wasn't actually a Zionist per se, but the reason lots of people assume that he was a Zionist is because of what he said after the Balfour Declaration, where he spoke publicly about the significance of it, and then later there was this famous San Remo Declaration in which incorporated the Balfour Declaration by the great powers. And after this, Rav Meir Simcha issued a letter in which he says, now there is no longer any need to be concerned with the three oaths. That is, these three oaths that the Talmud describes the Gentiles, three or four, there's different versions, that the Gentiles have various oaths upon them, and the Jews have oaths upon themselves, also. That is, they can't rebel against the nations of the world. Actually, the nations have one oath, that they can't oppress the Jews too much, and the Jews can't try to overtake the land, they can't rebel against the nations. Rabbi Meir Simcha says that now that the nations have given their authority, their approval of settlement and of the creation of a Jewish homeland, therefore there no longer is any prohibition in the Jews not just organizing Aliyah, but trying to mobilize to create a state. So clearly he is supportive of the idea of settling the land and even creating a homeland there. But notice that it's only after the San Remo Declaration that he comes out this way. So there's something even for the anti-Zionists here in that prior to the San Remo Declaration, Rav Meir Simcha, unlike many others, actually thought that the Gimel Shvuot, the three oaths, were not just agadic. Most people, especially Zionist figures, assume that these three oaths mentioned in the Talmud, this is an agadic statement. It doesn't have any significance. That is, that the Jews can't try to retake the land. But the truth is, as I mentioned before, that many rabbinic figures who you wouldn't expect, including Shimshon Frau Hirsch, think that this so-called agadic statement about the three oaths actually has practical halachic significance. So it turns out that Rameir Simcha, although he thinks that, he says that, well, San Remo voids any prohibition, but as I said, even the anti-Zionists could find some comfort here because they could use Rameir Simcha to say, oh, you see, even Rameir Simcha thought that this wasn't an agadic sort of statement. True, Rameir Simcha says that it's no longer applicable, and that we disagree with him, they can say. But the fact is that the great Rav Meir Simcha thought that this was a halachic statement that the Jews are obligated to remain in Galut until they're given permission to return, which, as I said, Rav Meir Simcha says they now have permission. Yisrael asks, imagine what he'd say after the UN vote and after the Holocaust. So, yes, he'd say the exact same thing, that there's no prohibition. Not only is there no prohibition, that now Jews can start returning to the land of Israel. That is not necessarily Zionism, though. That is love of Zion, that's love of return to the land, Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. But when we speak of Zionism, we mean like political Zionism, organizing for a state and seeing religious significance in the creation of a state, etc. But he's definitely sympathetic to Zionism, but not a card-carrying Zionist. And as with Rabbi Rinus, who was not only a card-carrying Zionist, but the Zionist par excellence, the head of Mizrahi movement, there is nothing messianic about his support of settling in the land. He doesn't speak about this as the beginning of the messianic age or anything like that. He even has a letter. Now, okay, if all we had was his statement after the San Remo conference, you might even see him as a Zionist. But we actually have another letter of his that was published just a few years ago in a Hebrew journal called Oraisa, in which he speaks about his love of the land of Israel. And we need to stress this because although you could say everyone loves the land of Israel and everyone thinks Aliyah is not important and settling the land, that's not really true. There's a whole school of thought, which obviously they think the land of Israel was holy, but Aliyah is not important. Aliyah is not significant until the Messianic era. The Satmar Rebbe writes about this. He holds that there's no mitzvah today to live in the land. There's always been such a position. Rav Meir Simcha doesn't have that position. It's funny that I was looking on the internet today. A.B. Yehoshua, Alephet Yehoshua, gave a talk in which he said that, I think it might have been on Buses Nias they covered this. He said that only Jews who live in Israel are real Jews. Everyone who lives in the diaspora, you're half Jews. And basically a very Zionistic talk. So you had all the Amoratsim on this website. They're all Amoratsim because, of course, they spend all their time on the internet instead of learning. Unfortunately, I spend a little too much time, but I justify it that I needed to have information to speak about and to write about. But you go on it. It was put up earlier today. You have all the Amoratsim criticizing Aleph Bet Yehoshua, that what's he talking about? We're complete Jews in the diaspora. You know, Torah Jews, that's what makes us important. Fine, you could say all this, but not one of them, at least not one of them from the first 30 or so before I stopped looking, knew enough to point out that although, yes, there is a position that you could be a complete Jew in Chutz La'aretz, what Aleph Bet Yehoshua was saying, without knowing it, of course, because he's not known as a Talmud Chacham at all, is exactly the Ramban. The Ramban is explicit, exactly what Aleph Bet Yehoshua said, that if you're living in a diaspora, you're half a Jew. You're not a complete Jew. The only place to be a complete Jew is living in the land of Israel. Now, obviously, Rav Kook and many others said that, but for the people who read this website, then Rav Kook isn't going to impress them. But the fact that not one of them could at least point out that Aleph Bet Yehoshua is saying exactly what the Ramban says, and not just the Ramban. Many others thought that the land of Israel is the place for the Jew. And Rav Meir Simcha says, Rav Meir Simcha says that all the mitzvos, Baruch asks, what does the Ramban say? Rav Meir Simcha says that all the mitzvos of Chutz La'aretz are all training. The real completion, the whole point of doing the mitzvos is only in Eretz Yisrael. We do it in training. And the Ramban says there's an obligation. It's a mitzvah mina Torah to live in the land of Israel. There's a hetter for certain reasons if you can't make a living or something. But the land of Israel is the place for all Jews, and that's the only place where mitzvos are really performed in the appropriate way. Yidol says, yes, and the Gemara says, one person didn't point it out. You don't need to go to Ramban. The Gemara says that anyone who lives in Chutz La'aretz says that you worship idols. But the idea that you're not a complete Jew is really developed by the Ramban. But yes, not just the Gemara says it. The Rambam says it. You'd rather live in Israel even with idolaters. No, he doesn't use the word half a Jew, Baruch. But that's what he's saying. That's not a paraphrase, I would say. I would say that's the proper exposition of what the Ramban is saying, that you're not a complete Jew if you're in the land of Israel. So much so that if you look at the Rabbi Soloveitchik's Conversations, which were published 2 years ago, he goes into detail about this Ramban, how he can't accept this Ramban. He rejects this Ramban in ways that you wouldn't expect Rabbi Soloveitchik to speak about a Rishon. He says, this can't be true. How could he say this? That Baalei Tosfos lived in, and the Rambam lived in the exile. They were diaspora Jews. And he says, I can't accept it. I can't accept this Ramban. It's impossible to say you're not a complete Jew in Chutz La'aretz. So if anyone's interested, this is in Rabbi Soloveitchik's Conversations, where he shows his, I would say, his anti-Zionist side. Rav Meir Simcha, in this letter, which I think is even on HebrewBooks.org, if not, I can send it to you from Otzar Chachma, he speaks of his love of the land of Israel as only being for holy reasons. That is, you can do mitzvot there, etc. Not for nationalistic reasons. He says that Jews do not love the land of Israel like the French love France. It's not that way. So we're not dealing with nationalism. And if you read writings of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Kook and others, I'm not sure about his father, but definitely other religious Zionists, they do speak about nationalism. in a way that approaches secular nationalism. It's just that this is a Torah nationalism. But Rameir Simcha, there's no nationalism, he tries to stress. He says it's all because of holiness, because of the Torah. Now I've told you why people think that Rameir Simcha is a Zionist. Although, as I just said, he's not. He's a lover of Zion and maybe tilting towards it. We have many who were like this, but you can't say he's a Zionist. Why then do some people think he's an anti-Zionist? That's because there are four letters that were published by Rav Meir Simcha in which he comes off as very anti-Zionist, completely opposed to Zionism, wait for the Messiah. The problem is these letters were published in a book called forget now what the title of the book was. Oh, a book published by Chaim Bloch, two volumes, or maybe it's three volumes, I forget now, of writings of great sages, all the great sages of the 19th and early 20th century against Zionism. And Rameir Simcha is in there. However, we know without any question that this book is a complete forgery. Rameir Simcha's letters in there are forgeries. All the other letters are forgeries. This is acknowledged even by everyone, as far as I know, in the Haredi world, in the anti-Zionist world. Rav Yochum Schlesinger, who's a big anti-Zionist in London, said that everyone knows they're forgeries. I've even shown some examples of how you can show they're forgeries. If I'm not mistaken, some of the letters were even written on Shabbos. He's a well-known forger. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, he has some letters in there from the Rugachever. And they're written as if the Rugachever is some German Orthodox rabbi. When anyone who knows the Rugachever knows how the Rugachever wrote. The Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote to Bloch saying that not only, he says that these are forgeries, and maybe Mr. Bloch or Rabbi Bloch, you were misled by publishing them, so Bloch writes back to defend them. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe replies that even if the Rugachever was standing in front of me right now and telling me he wrote these letters, I would say that it's still a forgery. So no one takes these letters seriously, any of the letters published by Bloch. Bloch published all sorts of forgeries, forgeries of the Chasam Sofer, forgeries of Rav Kook, loads and loads of forgeries. Before we go further, I'm not sure what... So the Notoria Carta site, Torah Jews Against Zionism, has these letters. Well, I don't know. I don't know what they're thinking. Maybe they don't know, or maybe they do know, they don't care. It's not even a question. Like, we have some letters where it's questionable that they're forgeries. And his early life in the 1920s until his death, Chaim Bloch published hundreds and hundreds of forgeries. I went through his archives. We have all of his archives at both the Leo Beck Institute and YIVO, and not surprisingly, not only do you find these letters, you don't even find copies of the letters. They're complete fiction made up by him. I showed how in the letter on Rav Kook, he published it two times, and he changed it between the second time he published it from the first time. Let me go back before we go further to the story, just briefly, of the Chafetz Chaim, because I want to tell you about how the Haredi biography dealt with this. Here we have a book mentioned by me before on the Or Sameach. It's hagiography, but hagiography could be very valuable if you know how to use it. Published 2001 by Asher Bergman. Asher Bergman is the son of Svi Bergman, who's the son-in-law of Rav Shach. This book, which has all sorts of interesting things, all sorts of Bab Meises as well, this leaves out everything that in today's day and age would be regarded as politically incorrect in the Haredi world. And let me just show you what they did with the dispute about the Chafetz Chaim. What he tells you is that there was a dispute at this conference. There was a dispute. But he doesn't tell you that Rav Meir Simcha said that the Chafetz... He said there's a dispute of different ideas, let's say. He doesn't tell you that Rav Meir Simcha said that the Chafetz Chaim had no place at the conference. I'll read you what he says on page 123. He says there was Eze Vikuach, Bein Rav Meir Simcha Chafetz Chaim. And he says the Chafetz Chaim thought that maybe he said something too sharp against Rav Meir Simcha. It's actually the other way around. But that's what he says. Now, this is an example of the political correctness. You get the whole story here in this book. You can find it in HebrewBooks.org by Zev Rabiner wrote a book on Rav Meir Simcha. He did a lot of work interviewing students, especially students, to create a picture of Rav Meir Simcha. And on page, those who want to check it, on page 41, I believe it's page, I don't know, it's a different story, yeah. On page 41, he tells a story. He tells a story that he heard. Let's see, does it say where he heard it from? No, I'm not sure where he got this story from. Oh, yes. Yeah, he heard it from... let's see. No, there's two similar stories. The second one, he tells it where he... It could be that the second story is also from the author of the first story, Rabbi Kalmes, who was the Rav of Moscow. And then he came to Eretz Yisrael. Here's the story. It says that a young couple came to see Rav Meir Simcha, and they were alone with him for a while. And then people outside, they heard the noise of singing and dancing. So the person who told the story was curious. What's the singing and dancing? So he opens up the door, looks in, and he saw that the three of them, that is Rav Meir Simcha, the husband, and the wife, were singing and dancing together. When the couple left, Rav Meir Simcha told Rav Sakruta, actually that's probably told in the story, Rav Sakruta, the story comes from Rav Sakruta. That's where he got it from. Rav Sakruta is the son-in-law of Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein. He told Rav Sakruta, don't find this strange that I was dancing with them. These people are from the elites of the city of Dvinsk. Children of important people, and these important people, their parents are my friends. The husband wanted to divorce the wife for no reason. I spoke to the husband. I convinced him not to do so, and finally, after great efforts, they were in there for a while, he was convinced to make peace with his wife. And in order to strengthen this shalom bayis, this peace, I danced with them around the table, and we sang together. And I hope that the peace, the shalom bayis, will be long-lasting. That's the story. This is the only version we have of the story, at least the first version, the authentic version. If you look in Bergman's book, page 206, the first thing to note is that it's taken from Rabiner's book almost word for word. Almost word for word. Now, he says in the note that Rav Sakruta told this story to Rav Shach. And that could, and that's where he's getting from Rav Shach. Now, that could be so, but I don't think so. Especially if you look, you can see Bergman is copying it. He's plagiarizing it. Look at the language he uses, it directly from Rabiner. Now, it could be that Rav Shach got the story from Rabiner and then told it to Bergman, his grandson, and Bergman just assumes that he heard it from Sakruta. And why would that be possible? Well, because this book has a haskama, lo and behold, haskama from none other than Rav Shach. So obviously Rav Shach had the book and he read it. I think this is doubly significant because in this entire book, in which Bergman copies a great deal from Rabiner, plagiarizes a great deal, he never thanks him, never mentions him, except for I found one reference to him. You'd think that there'd be in the introduction where he talks about, I'm doing a book on Rav Shach, that on Rav Meir Simcha, that I benefited a lot, I took a lot of material from Rabiner, nothing. Not at all. And that's where he got, he talks about the different stories that were around, the people I heard it from, books I used, and yet most of the book is copied from this text. So if you look on page 206 of the Bergman book, you get the story. But look at this. What does he say? Oh, this is unbelievable. he says that, you know, the whole thing, I looked in, and Rameir Simcha told, explained the same thing, explained it. But what did he see? I looked in, this is Rav Sakruta, and I saw Shnei B'nei Azug, the couple, Rokdin Yachad in Rameir Simcha, dancing together with Rameir Simcha, Be'em Sa'ut Mitpachat Mizaviv HaShulchan, Umazamri Mitzavta, and singing together. They were dancing together with a handkerchief between them, around the table. Now, the problem is that the original story has them dancing around the table. What it means, there's no question what it means, is that you have Rameir Simcha in the front, Rameir Simcha is holding the husband's hand, and the husband is holding the wife's hand. And that's how they went around the table. But he's afraid that people will think that when it says that, you know, they were dancing, going around the table, let me read you the language in Rabiner, he's afraid that people will read it and will think Chas v'shalom that Rameir Simcha was actually holding the woman's hand, and therefore he heads in this piece. It says, what is it? He looked in Rasakruta, he saw Shloshtam Rokdim Umazamri Mitzavta. He saw three of them, doesn't say around the table, he saw the three of them dancing and singing Mitzavta together. All Bergman does is he takes these words, he adds a table, so you can imagine it, and he adds in the bit about the handkerchief. So that's the way these people write biographies. You know, they don't mind putting things in. God forbid you come to the wrong conclusion. He doesn't do anything. He says, Mizamri Mitzavta. Truthfully, he didn't think about it. Had he thought about it, he probably would have said, you know, husband and Rameir Simcha and the husband were singing. All it says is Mizamri Mitzavta singing together. He probably assumed that everyone knows the wife couldn't have been singing. But if he had any assumption that maybe would people think the wife was also singing, he would have corrected that also. Now, the reason why I think, despite the fact that Rav Shach has the approbation, why he leaves out any mention of Rabiner is because Rabiner is a known Zionist, a well-known Mizrahi figure. Rabiner wrote a whole book. In addition to a book on Rameir Simcha, he wrote about other Gedolim. He has a book called Or Mufla on Rav Kook, which is dedicated to Shazar, the president. So he's the sort of person that you don't want to mention in the Haredi world. But as I said, the entire book is plagiarized. And I just read you the words. They are almost word for word, except for what he adds. Okay, returning to the story of Rameir Simcha and the Chavetz Chaim, I now want to read you something else, which no one knows about. I plan on dealing with this in the Sfarim blog, not with this story, but with other things. I am in possession of a lengthy autobiography of an important Rosh Yeshiva, who's no longer alive. This autobiography can never be published by any press in the Haredi world, because it's honest, and because the Rosh Yeshiva tells you about his dealings with various Gedolim and his relationships. It was given to me, and I was told I can do whatever I want with it. It was given to me by the person who taped and transcribed all this, because the Rosh Yeshiva wanted it to appear in print. The person who gave it to me, the Rosh Yeshiva did this Rosh Yeshiva, whose name I will not mention yet, because I want to, it'll all come out. He wanted it to appear in print. And the person who was tasked with it is just, it's not his thing. He was able to, and then there's problems. The book needs to be edited because the people who transcribed it, they're misidentifying individuals. The Rosh Yeshiva says one person and they misunderstand him, and sometimes the Rosh Yeshiva is wrong on the facts. But it's still valuable, first of all, to know about the Rosh Yeshiva. Second of all, it's valuable to about some of the stories he tells, because if he's an eyewitness, it's very authentic, and he has some great stuff in it. But let me read you about his visit with Rav Shach. And this is about a page. And you'll see, even here, you'll see part of the problems that I spoke about, getting things accurate. I once visited, by the way, I'll tell you, because of my now writing on the Sfarim blog, and I have a whole following in the Hasidic world and the Litvish world, the things people send me, they don't want to publicize it, but they want me to publicize it. And for the most part, I don't mind, although let me just tell you, I mean, I'll say this now, I know it's going to get picked up. There's someone, nice guy, a guy I find interesting, who listens, and for the last few years, he's been excerpting Mark Shapiro's greatest lines, what he thinks are my greatest lines, and he puts them all up on the internet. As those of you who listen to me know, we'll have a whole hour shiur, and there'll be all sorts of good history and stories and Torah, and there'll be some strange, interesting stories, and he excerpts it. Now, those of you who listen to me, and those of you who listen not live, but listen to the MP3s, know that there's an Ikar and a Tafel. That is the main, and then there's a secondary. And although the secondary is definitely interesting, the main part is the history. I think people who listen, who just see the excerpts, think I'm sitting here telling all sorts of stories, and we sit here for an hour and tell stories, because he's only interested in excerpting the stories. And some of the stories are very good, and I'm happy he does this. And there's someone created a Wikipedia page for me, and there's even a link there to all these stories. But I will say that I think you get a bit of it's an unbalanced thing that you just hear stories that are quoted. Also, those of you who know, when you listen, it's a little extemporaneous. If I would be writing it, I'd formulate it more carefully. You can appreciate that when you're listening. When you write it, it might come out a little differently. In any event, so I'm sure this is going to appear on his website. So, and that's fine. Whatever I say, I know can be put out there. And I appreciate the effort he takes to put this online. But let me read you. Oh, so what was I saying? Someone, the only time I didn't put something, and someone sent me a picture of a great Hasidic Rebbe swimming. And he said that in his Hasidic group, they tell story when this Rebbe was young, 15 years old, 16 years old. He's with another Hasid, and he says that he's tired, that in his Hasidic group, they talk about their Rebbe as if their Rebbe from day one, all he did was learn, and he never had a childhood. And he said, here is a wonderful picture, which he got because he had his access to the Rebbe's house, the deceased Rebbe. And he took it, and someone took it and gave it to him, and he gave it to me. And that, although I'll mention it in a post, I can mention it, I'm not going to do the, I won't put the picture online, I told him, because I think it's a question of, especially in that world, I mean, it's not sneeze to see someone, a Rebbe, without their shirt on. It's a question of, it's a little voyeuristic. It's not meant. It's a family picture. I mean, it wasn't taken secretly. The Rebbe's there. You look at him. I would show it to any of you if I could do it without sending it, because once I send it, only me and him and maybe a couple others are the only people who have it. If I send it, then it'll get out everywhere. But if anyone is close to me, you know, if I could show you in person without sending it, I would. It's a young teenager swimming with an older chassid. But it still, I think, is a violation of privacy because, you know, none of us, I think, want to have pictures of us unless we're in perfect shape and maybe we're swimmers. We don't want to have pictures of us in our bathing suits spread around the world. Look, the Chazon Ish loved going swimming. We spoke about that. He would go swimming. So if I would stay there, wait when I knew he was going to go swimming and took a picture of him secretly, I just think it's a violation of privacy. So I am not going to be publicizing the picture of this Rebbe. Eventually, I am sure it will get out. In today's day and age, everything gets out. Everyone, there is no more privacy, unfortunately. Everything is put online eventually. That's just the world we're in. But be that as it may. No, this Rebbe is no longer alive. I can say the Rebbe. It's the Bubba for Rebbe. It's the previous Bubba for Rebbe. I don't mind saying the picture, but I won't publicize it because I don't think it's appropriate. I think it's worth letting people know that the Bubba for Rebbe, a great tzaddik, one who in the Holocaust suffered terribly. I believe he lost as many of his family members. I was at his tish 3 or 4 times in Borough Park. I received from his hand not the shirayim, but the coasts of wine. And but I have no problem saying that the Bubba for Rebbe, when he was young, he also had a childhood. He went swimming. There's nothing wrong with going swimming. You're supposed to go swimming. But I'm not going to publicize the picture, even though when he was 15 years old. But if I believe it's Rosh Shlomo. Yes. No, it's Rosh Shlomo. So let me read you the story here by this Rosh Yeshiva, who for now will remain unnamed, but as I said, there's all sorts of good stories to come. I once visited Rav Shach with a friend of mine 10 or 12 years ago. These memoirs were recorded in the 90s. I was in a bit of a hurry, but Rav Shach had a story he really wanted to tell me, so he held me back. In the Biur HaLacha in Hilchos Shofar, the Chafetz Chaim writes that the shofar should be blown from the right side. He writes that he heard a source for this from Rav Meir Simcha. It was a verse in Tanakh. Actually, if you look in the Mishnah Berurah there, Biur HaLacha didn't say he heard it from Rav Meir Simcha. He said he heard that Rav Meir Simcha said. He told us the reason Chafetz Chaim did this, even though he didn't cite other contemporaries. He wanted to make sure that people didn't think he was angry at Rav Meir Simcha. It was at the time that the Russian government passed a law that Russian had to be part of the curriculum of the Volozhiner Yeshiva. So here you see the same confusion that Rav Soloveitchik had. This had nothing to do with the Volozhiner Yeshiva. It was, as we saw, a congress that rabbis should learn Russian so that the spiritual rabbis can be take over. The Russian government wanted all rabbis to know Russian. It had nothing to do with the Volozhiner Yeshiva, which was closed already 20 years. And in the Bergman book, he has it right when it took place. All the Gedolim held a big meeting to decide whether they should accept the law and keep the yeshiva open or not accept it and close the yeshiva down. By the way, since he mentions this meeting, if he knew his history, which I don't blame him, Rav Shach's job is to learn Torah, not to know history, but there was never a big meeting. This decision was made by the Netziv. Maybe he consulted Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. I assume he did and some others, but there never was a big meeting. No one was ever called. And if anyone wants to know about the history of the Volozhiner Yeshiva, 2 weeks ago appeared, after the long wait, the English version of Shaul Stamfer's book, Three Lithuanian Yeshivas, published by Lippmann Library. It is not just a translation of the Hebrew. New material has been added, so you could say it's a new edition. I hope that I'm going to tell Beagle Eisen, I don't know if Beagle Eisen knows, he doesn't always carry Lippmann. He carried my books and some others. I'm going to tell Beagle Eisen, because this is going to be a bestseller in the Haredi world. Let me make a note of this. He's a good friend of mine, Stamfer, so I'm going to tell him that they should order. It wasn't ready for the YU book sale, or it would have sold 200. I don't know if any of you have it. I was just sent my copy the other day. So let me continue reading from the Rosh Yeshiva. The Lubavitch Rebbe of the time attended too. He was close with all the Gedolim. He was like a Litvak. They decided to close the yeshiva. The Chafetz Chaim addressed the gathering to say that the yeshiva should close. Again, the Chafetz Chaim, all he was interested in was that rabbis should not learn Russian and that you shouldn't put it into the yeshivas, but not Volozhin. Rav Meir Simcha made a comment to the effect that a little Jew from a little town shouldn't get involved in an issue like this. He dismissed him. So Rav Shach has the story correct, that Rav Meir Simcha basically said that he's not a rabbi. And he has he's no business being here. Now let me go on. The Chafetz Chaim was very close with Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Rav Chaim told him, "Don't feel bad. Your book, Shmiras HaLashon, is a more important work than his Or Sameach." That's what Rav Shach reported. I don't know if the story's true. In fact, I assume it's not true, because Rav Shach is telling his third or fourth person. Rav Shach concluded, "That's the reason I think the Chafetz Chaim cites Rav Meir Simcha. He wanted to show the world he's not mad at him, even though he insulted him. Rav Shach made a big deal of this point." Then the Rosh Yeshiva adds, in parentheses, "This is the authentic version of the story. Another book mentions it, but distorts it." I don't know what he's referring to, but this story is mentioned in many places. Walking out, now this is the Rosh Yeshiva speaking. "Walking out, I asked my colleague what he thought was the reason behind Rav Shach's excitement. He suggested that it was because Rav Shach was a very elderly man, and he was already living in a different sphere. These were the kinds of things that were on his mind, and he wanted to get feedback from us. I got home, and I got a call from Hillel Zaks, older brother Herschel. He asked me to do him some favor with the government. I made the necessary phone calls, and then I called him back. He was a grandson of the Chafetz Chaim. I mentioned to him that I had just visited Rav Shach, and he told me this interesting story. He, that is Hillel Zaks, said, my father, that's Rav Mendel Zaks, asked the Chafetz Chaim exactly the same question. And the Chafetz Chaim gave exactly the same answer that Rav Shach gave. I figured, end of quote. Rosh Hashiva speaking again. I figured that there was no way I could make Rav Shach happier than with this bit of information. The next day I was at a wedding in Bnei Brak, so I hopped over to Rav Shach. I walked in and there seemed to be nobody in the house besides him. I wanted to set him up a bit and I started to say I had something to tell him. I wanted to make it really dramatic. He said, out with it already. So I told him and he jumps as high as the chandelier and hugs me and kisses me. He said, you've added a piece onto my life. In other words, he told the story that the story that Rav Shach knew, this legend, that the reason that the Chafetz Chaim mentions Rav Meir Simcha is because of he wanted to appease him, to show him that he wasn't upset. If Rav Meir Simcha got angry at him, he wasn't upset with him. And he told him in the name of the Chafetz Chaim's grandson that the Chafetz Chaim's son-in-law asked the Chafetz Chaim this very question. Why, out of all the Gedolim, the only contemporary Gedolim you mentioned is the Or Sameach. It's a great story, interesting. The problem is, as we saw last week, the last volume of the Mishnah Berurah appeared in 1908, and this Congress, this conference, was in 1910. So, again, there's confusion here, and who's to say what Rav Mendel Zaks heard from the Chafetz Chaim, and then by the time it got to Hillel Zaks, and by the time it got to the Rosh Yeshiva, how much it's been changed. I mentioned last week, and I think the authentic story is, at the Congress, where Meir Simcha and the rest of the Gedolim were in attendance, the Chafetz Chaim comes, where Meir Simcha's attitude is like, what are you doing here? You're not a Rav of the city, you have no business being here. That's the story. Then the Bava Maisa, the addition is that this explains why his name is mentioned in the Mishnah Berurah. That has to remain teku. We don't know why, out of all the Gedolim, he's mentioned. But I bring this only as an example to show how the story has changed in so many different ways. Before we go on, let me just say before I look at the questions, I do at least think we have to give credit to Bergman for at least telling us that there was a dispute between Rav Meir Simcha and the Chafetz Chaim. He doesn't tell us what the dispute's about. That's what's amazing. He just tells us that there was some dispute between them and, he says there was some dispute, Ezevikuach, and the Chafetz Chaim was afraid that maybe he spoke sharply. He doesn't want to tell us that, God forbid, he doesn't want to tell us that the dispute was about secular studies and learning the Russian language, and that Rav Meir Simcha actually supported it. That would create a problem in Bnei Brak today. How can you publish a hagiography of Rav Meir Simcha when Rav Meir Simcha is advocating something that they don't believe in today, that you should have any secular education? But I give him credit still for at least mentioning that there was a dispute. This reminds me, I forgot to check Rav David of Karlin. I told Bill I would check him. What exactly he says on this. I will check this after we're done. Let me just answer the questions before we go on. Baruch tells us one of the early Bava Rebbe's almost drowned. Very interesting. Yidol said, Beagle Eyes and Sony, the Hebrew edition. Yes, but the English edition, they asked to order it directly from... I wouldn't buy the English edition if you already have the Hebrew edition, because the second Hebrew edition in 2005, it's pretty much a translation. If you only have the earlier edition, there's a lot of new materials, including the closing of the Volozhin Yeshiva. But for most people, most Americans, it's easier to read English, and there are some things added. Next year, they won't recommend your book. Could be. Let's return to the biography. I have to give Beagle Eisen Hakara Satov. Beagle Eisen has always carried my material. He carried when Limits of Orthodox Theology came out. There was a whole article in the foreword about it because Eichler's in Borough Park refused to carry it, although Eichler's in Flatbush did carry it. Beagle Eisen, not only did he carry it, he put it out, he sold many copies, so, as I said, I owe him Hakara Satov. In 1906, Rav Meir Simcha was asked by the leaders of Jerusalem, that is, the leaders of the community, to come assist Rav Shmuel Salant as Rav of Jerusalem. He wanted to take the position, But the people of Davinsk wrote a strong letter to Jerusalem complaining that, why are you trying to take our Rav? That's always a problem. You often have this, that in those days they loved their rabbis, or they loved their great rabbis, and when another city would want, the rabbis would usually move up, and that they would complain that you're taking our rabbi. And but the contract, the rabbinic contract, was such that the rabbi could always get out of it, and the rabbis did always get out of it. They were always looking to move up. I mean, rabbinic salaries in Eastern Europe were, they're really poverty wages, almost starvation wages. Yeah, they gave you a house, but very, very little money. If you got a job at a bigger city, you moved up in the world, and you had a much better parnassa. So it was understandable that people wanted to. Just, is it any different than today? Although I don't recall any examples in America where a rabbi wants to go to a bigger city and the community, maybe there are some, writes to the city. You know, maybe he's in a small town and he wants to move to Los Angeles, and they write to Los Angeles saying that, no, don't take our rabbi. And all these examples where they say they don't take our rabbi, it usually doesn't tell us if they raise his salary. The only example where they do that is Nicholsburg. When Hirsch was going to go to Frankfurt, they wrote a letter to Frankfurt, said, we don't want him to leave. And then they hardly ever paid Hirsch. They paid him, like they said, very little. And it was very difficult for him to make a living. When they saw he was about to leave and go to Frankfurt, then all of a sudden they're willing to raise his salary. And they offered to give dowries for his daughters when they got married, to give him everything under the sun. Had they done that years ago, maybe he wouldn't have looked for another job. Ah, thank you, Shlomo. Let's discuss now some of his ideas. While I'm waiting, I think maybe one more person is writing. Shlomo says that Beagle Eisen always recommends my stuff, so just another example of why I need to give them thanks and Hakara Satov. It's amazing that a place like Beagle Eisen can not just survive, but prosper. They have no website. There's no... you can't buy books online from them. Larry says that the salary competition is hardly different from any academic setting today. Yeah, that's exactly the case. The people looking to move into the big universities in the big cities, many universities will fight. If they think someone's worth it, they'll fight for them. But in the rabbinic world, I don't see it. There may be examples, but I haven't seen it, or I'm unaware of any, where a rabbi tells the community he wants to leave. There might be examples where the community raises his salary, but where the community actually writes or tries to contact the other community and says, please don't take him. We want him here. He's doing such a good job here. It's the free market. It's not the other community's problem if he wants to leave. Oh, so Miller in Toronto wanted to go to Lake of Oak? Okay, very interesting. I didn't know that. Rameir Simcha, his brilliance is well known. And I want to discuss some of his ideas. It really isn't the setting here to discuss his most important contributions. If you want to look in Rav Zevin's Ishim V'Shitot, he takes various sugyot, where Meir Simcha's brilliant expositions in the Or Sameach. To do that, we'd have to talk about a sugya for 15, 20 minutes, and then talk about the Rambam and maybe Rashi and other commentaries, and then this isn't really that sort of class. So I tried to find some examples where it's easier to explain it. And we'll talk about some of these ideas. Before we get to that, though, let me tell you, though, he also had a critical sense. He isn't just a traditional Talmudist. He, just to give you one example, was one of the first to recognize this forgery for what it was. Look on the left here. There are three great forgeries in the 20th century. Well, when you think, first of all, let's talk about forgeries. Jewish history is full of forgeries. Dating back a long time. And in terms of the great forgeries in the last few hundred years, I think Besamim Rosh has to be up there. Then comes the Jerusalem Talmud. What other forgeries? Well, Chaim Bloch's forgeries are important. His book Against Zionism. Let's see, what other forgeries are there? There's some other significant forgeries that someone will email it in. But off the top of my head, there's one other great forgery which is escaping me. I feel a little bit like the governor of Texas here, where he said that the agencies he wants to close down, and they can't remember which they are. There's a lot of small forgeries, but I must be missing one other major forgery. Maybe not. Maybe in terms of the big 20th century forgeries, this is the big one. Oh, the Eshkol. That's the other one. Yeah, the Sefer Eshkol. 19th century halakhic work. This work, Jerusalem Talmud, when it first appeared, it fooled not just the traditional Torah scholars, it also fooled the academic scholars, at least many of them. It fooled the Chafetz Chaim. He started wearing Tefillin Rabbeinu Tam, according to his son, because of this. There is a Rabbi Oberlander in Budapest. The Chabad Rav of Budapest has written numerous articles, as well as a doctoral dissertation, which hasn't yet appeared in print. It will one day. It's basically all of his articles on this dispute. He knows more about this than anyone who's ever lived in all the details, including the Salman Schechter angle, many other important things. So it appears, I'm not going to go through the whole history of this now, we can have a special class on this. It appears with haskamot, with approbations by many, many great rabbis, and also by notes by various figures, including Rav Shalom Mordechai Shvadron, one of the great, great poskim in the late 19th, early 20th century. Some people call him the posek achron. I mean, a posek of posek. He has notes. And also the academic scholar Shlomo Buber. He has notes. So this Friedlander, he acts like he's a Sephardi there. You see, Samach Tet, he tries to fool everyone. It all came out eventually. He was where he was born. It was, I think, in Germany, near the border. But not only did you need the traditional scholars, you need the academic scholars also to disprove it. The Or Sameach, together with his compatriot in Divinsk, was one of the early figures to identify this as a forgery. He also wrote many responsa. This is a question I think was Baruch last class. We spoke about it two classes ago. We are told, if you look in the introduction to the two-volume Shelos HaTshuvos Or Sameach, published by Machon Yerushalayim, we're told that he had volumes, volumes and volumes, many volumes, ready to be printed. But these were lost during World War II. One volume survived. How did it survive? One volume of numerous volumes, probably the equivalent of 10 volumes. One volume he gave to Rabbi Zak, who was the Rav of Riga, Rachel Mendel Zak, to print it. Rabbi Zak never ended up printing it. It survived the war and ended up in YIVO. How it got to YIVO in New York, I'm not sure. But it wasn't with the rest of the materials, and that's why it survived, including all the thousands of letters that the Or Sameach had. It was all lost and destroyed in World War II, like the writings of many other Gedolim. Rabbi Chana Wasserman had boxes and boxes of writings. Rabbi Menachem Zemba had writings. All these, Rabbi Jacob Weinberg, three books already prepared for publication, and hundreds of tshuvot. These are losses that we will never get back. Great rabbis who no one ever heard of because they were never able to publish their Sfarim. So all we have is two volumes of tshuvot, really one volume divided into two sections that survived. I'm not going to deal with any of the questions. They're typical questions. Nothing really stands out. One I thought was noteworthy only because of the issues that we go through today with conversion. Yerodan number 32, he's asked from England, can you convert a woman for the sake, she wants to marry someone who's Jewish. Can you convert her? And he gives what really, until relatively recent times, was the standard answer of post-scheme, that 100% you can convert her. although the Gemara says that you don't convert people like this, we already have a tshuva of the Rambam that says that if it's a choice between converting them and they're going to live together anyway, it's better to convert them. There he's referring to a slave, that, you know, if you're intimate with a slave girl, you can't then marry her, the girl, but the Rambam says, nevertheless, the practice is that we do allow them to get married because it's better to have this little infraction and save the person from a lifetime of sins. And Rameir Simcha says, yes, although it's not the best thing, and it's not L'shem Shemayim, it's simply L'shem, it's for the sake of marriage. Nevertheless, we convert the woman, and she will, eventually it'll be L'shem Shemayim. He assumes you have to, there has to be acceptance of Torah and Mitzvos, but again, you have to put yourself in the mind here. What is Torah and Mitzvos? What does it mean, Torah and Mitzvos? It means that you'll be Jewish, you accept the Torah, but it doesn't mean accepting Torah and Mitzvos as if they're required today. How can it be? We're dealing with a woman who the Mar Sameach says is not doing L'shem Shemayim. She just wants to marry the guy, so she'll agree to observe Shabbos and Kashrus, but we're not dealing with the greatest at Tzaddikim here. And we already saw Rav Chaim Moser Grozinski, what he says, that acceptance of Torah and Mitzvos, even though you acknowledge that you have titles and you'll violate certain things, that doesn't void the conversion. Not a very significant shuv, only because, as I said, this is the standard approach to conversion among poskim before modern times, that especially for marriage, you don't ask many questions, especially if they're already living with each other or going to be living with each other. You convert them, and you try to keep them as religious as you can. But then I never had this idea of conversion classes, and then you don't make it difficult. You try to convert them. We've spoken about this already in the past. I'm not going to do it anymore. Let's talk about some of his ideas. We have about 3 minutes. We can get started at least. He has many significant ideas, both in the Or Sameach and in the Meshech Chachma. Supposedly, he said, that while he could have written the Or Sameach in his youth, the Meshech Chachma is a book that could only be written in his mature years. For those academic scholars, they agree with this judgment, assuming Rameir Simcha ever said it, but if you're a traditional Talmudist, you might have problems with that, you might deny that he said it, but it's quoted that that's what he said, and the Or Sameach, a brilliant work, is it a work of traditional Talmudic scholarship, Rambam scholarship, but the Meshech Chachma is different. It does require more originality. The Meshech Chachma cites everything. He cites Zohar, Kabbalah, philosophy. It's a commentary on the Torah, but much more. In other words, I think you can say about the Meshech Chachma, it's really not a commentary on the Torah in the sense we often think of it. It's the format of a commentary, but in discussing any particular verse, he uses this as a jumping-off point to discuss anything under the sun that has relevance to the verse. And so it's a work of religious philosophy, of Jewish religious philosophy, in the context of a commentary. You have many examples of this. This is typical, where people, especially in biblical commentaries, they use this as an excuse to then go off and discuss all sorts of things. And there are many articles, good articles, that deal with the Or Sameach. We even have, Rameir Simcha. We even have a book by Yonah Ben Sasson on the Meshech Chachma, on his ideas. Yitzhak Blau, the son of Rabbi Blau, the Mashkiach Ruchani of YU, has a series of articles on the virtual base Medrash, which I looked at and made use of. Louis Jacobs wrote a book, collected essays called Judaism and Theology. And in there, there's a chapter on Rav Meir Simcha. A lot of good stuff in this book, by the way. Good stuff. So there's a lot to use. Louis Jacobs was very attracted. I knew Louis Jacobs. He was quite attracted to Rav Meir Simcha, as was Yishai Leibovitz. I already mentioned that he's the figure that Western intellectuals, they find him attractive as Jewish intellectuals. He shows a humanistic tendency, Rav Meir Simcha. That would also be found attractive by some people. It causes him to soften some of the, I guess you could say, some of the biblical villains. I think it's already 10, and I don't want to now, since it's already 10, I'm not going to get into it. We're going to begin next semester with some important ideas in the Or Sameach. in the Meshech Chachma as well as in Yor Sameach. I'll give you something in Yor Sameach and talk about what made Rav Meir Simcha, because the biography is very interesting. But if it wasn't for the Yor Sameach and the Meshech Chachma, we wouldn't be telling the biography. It's precisely because of his works, the Yor Sameach and Meshech Chachma, that makes the biography significant and worthwhile. So I will stop now. Thank everyone again. I will repeat what I say after every single class that I enjoyed very much teaching this semester. And although I hope you learned a great deal from me, as always, I learned a great deal from you, not just from your questions, keeping on my toes online. By all the people who comment in, including this semester, new people, Yidol, and especially Yidol and Baruch, keeping me on my toes, which is good. All of you who don't comment here, but email me, and the people who listen on MP3, asking me questions, pointing things out, correcting improper formulations, etc. I thank you very much, and I hope you found it as enjoyable and as interesting as I did. So let me take some questions. There's two, which Baruch? There's two Baruchs here. But you've asked a number of questions, so I thank you. And Yisrael, of course, always with his questions. I appreciate it. As we know, I repeat this all the time, the sages tell us you learn more from your students. And I've always said, you know, I'm working in Scranton. It's a non-Jewish university. What can I learn from my students? Maybe I learned certain things, but not about Jewish things. So here, the virtual students I have, I learn a great deal, and I appreciate it. And even the ones who maybe don't comment so much, I email. As Bill knows, whenever I have questions, I email him. So I thank you again for a wonderful semester. Before I answer questions, in case I forget, I want to wish everyone a good Pesach, and hope to see you again. I will stay on a couple minutes if anyone has any questions or comments on what we did today. Baruch says he missed last week's shiur, but listens to the recording. Many corrections and comments. He will email them, and I will get to that next class. Yisrael says that you read that he was offered positions in New York and elsewhere. I don't know. I in the biographies, the Bergman and the Rabiner, my recollection is they don't mention him being offered biographies. Being offered positions in New York. If I'm not mistaken, there's references that during the Yaakov Yosef, before Yaakov Yosef was picked, he maybe was a candidate. I don't know if that's true though. Did I get soft matzah for this year? I haven't gotten it yet. I was supposed to go today, but it didn't work out. I think I'm going to go on Friday, apparently, if I can get there. If not, I'll get there next week. I definitely need my soft matzah, so I could do korech the same way that Hillel did it. If you know korech, it's supposed to be wrapped. So that means it has to be, you have to wrap it to make it the way Hillel did it, a sandwich. Our matzah is really not like a sandwich. If you look in the Chasam Sofer, look in the Minhagim of the Chasam Sofer, he talks about how from the middle matzah he would give a piece of kazayis from the middle matzah and give it to everyone. If the Chasam Sofer's matzah was the same matzah we had, he couldn't give everyone a kazayis from the middle matzah. Nowhere near, because basically a kazayis is almost a whole matzah. So, it's obvious that the Chasam Sofer was using much thicker matzahs, i.e., what we call soft matzah, when he was at his Seder. Not just him, if you look at all the earlier sources, they speak in terms of thicker matzahs. You can see from the size of their kazayis, the way they describe it, that they were not using our very thin matzahs. So I like to get the matzahs. I don't know how Baruch knows that, but he knows it. So unless this is Baruch, I don't remember, unless this is the Baruch who went with me last year, Motzei Shabbos, about a year ago, when I was in Flatbush for Shabbos, and we went together. I gave a talk at the Sephardic Institute for the Syrian show, and two guys and me walked over afterwards to get the matzahs. So, and he took a picture of me, so unless that's you, I don't know how you know about the soft matzahs, but it's nothing to hide. I'm very proud of it. What does Roshach write in the Haskama? You can see it, by the way, on HebrewBooks.org, the book. He writes, it's a nothing little haskama. He says that you have a great zechut, that you're able to write a book on Rav Meir Simcha. His book, Rav Meir Simcha's books, Enlighten Our Eyes, it's to the end of time until Mashiach. It's a great zechus you have. That's all. Nothing significant. So it's Baruch. Well, then, thank you, Baruch. I look forward then to your comments and questions and even corrections, because I can tell you Baruch knows, he knows Gedolim and he knows the history. So if I knew when I was going, Baruch, 100%, I would call you. You could meet me. You could ride your bike there. Yisrael says, did I mention his relationship with the Rogatchover? I haven't yet. I'll mention it next semester. There's a great story of him and the Rogatchover. Remind me next semester. Am I going to write a Hebrew Sefer someday? I published 2 Hebrew Sfarim, but I don't really write Sfarim so much. I write books. But maybe I'll collect all my Hebrew articles and I'll put them in a Sefer. I don't know. Yisrael says, as a Rav in a town rather than a Rosh Yeshiva, would he have students? Yes, he would have students, because Rav Meir Simcha gave shir. Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had students. He didn't have a yeshiva in his town. He had what's called a kibbutz, they used to call it, or today we might call it a chabura. You had students who would come, and he would give a shir. This was the traditional old way of doing things, where rabbis would have small groups of students, maybe they would have 10 of them. Later on, then you have great yeshivas, but you would often have people who would travel to small towns. We know the great yeshivas, but even when there were great yeshivas, you still had rabbis in towns in which people would come to study with them, and that was a very common thing. So yes, he has people who are regarded as his students. At least they say they're his students. What does that mean? That means they were living in Dvinsk. They would learn the base medrash, and they would ask some questions, and he would even give shir. He would speak to, he would talk to, sometimes he would only talk to them in learning, sometimes he would actually give a shir. In Brisk, for example, they would actually have a shir with, when I say a shir, you get together with Rav Elbel, let's say, and he would go over a sugya. So Rav Meir Simcha would also have people who he would teach in these sort of informal settings. Now, Baruch, not for me. What was the name of Rabbi Ner Sefer? Rabbi Meir Simcha HaKohen. What's good about his books is that at the end of all of them, there are letters of various Rabbanim, various Gedolim. In this book, you have a couple from Rabbi Yechiyak of Weinberg, and you have others. You have about 4 or 5 letters here from Rabbi Weinberg. I reprinted all of them. I don't know that Rav Shach read the book. No, but I'm... look, either Rav Shach heard the story on the grapevine, or he read it in the book. He definitely did not hear it from Rav Meir. What does the text say here? In the version of the Rosh Yeshiva, he said, let me tell you exactly what he says. He says he writes that he heard this from Rav Meir Simcha. That's not true. I mean, Rav Shach didn't hear the story from Rav Meir Simcha. Rav Meir Simcha died, you know, when Rav Shach was just a kid. He wasn't a kid, a teenager. He went and heard it from him. This is the quote. Rav Shach, he writes that he... I'm sorry. That's the Chavetz Chaim you heard it from Rav Shach. Here he doesn't say that he heard it from Rav Meir Simcha. No, he's just quoting it as a story. So, okay. So he's either quoting a story that's well-known in the yeshiva world, or he heard it from the book. Yeah, I don't know if he read the book. But why? I mean, I'm assuming he at least skimmed through the book. He wrote a haskama for it. The author sent him the book afterwards. So, I don't know. Oh, Baruch, you're joking today. What do I hold of Daf Yomi? I mentioned before, I'm not such a big fan of Daf Yomi. Because I don't know if Daf Yomi is really a success. Yes, it's revolutionized things, but I told you that I know people who can't even read a line in Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, and yet they've been through Shas. I know someone, he tells me he's been through, another 2 years, he'll be through all of Shas. And he doesn't know anything, he's not Maritz. I mean, what does it mean, go through Shas? there's a shul. I'm not going to say which shul, but I saw online they have Daf Yomi every day, half hour. They do Daf Yomi in a half hour. I don't think any shul takes more than an hour to do it. Many shuls do it in 45 minutes. How is that, really, how is that learning? Part of learning is the struggle and trying to understand it. If you just sit there and someone just speaks quick words, you can't follow it. I think I have a pretty good head. I've tried to listen to some of these shiur, and I'm still thinking about what the Magid shiur said, and he's already on two lines down. So it seems to me that Daf Yomi is really ritual. It's sort of like going to a minyan. People feel they're participating in something, and that's good also. You feel like you're participating in an amazing thing. Thousands and thousands of people at the same day are doing the same daf, so it's a spiritual experience. But I don't think it's really learning. And if you're speaking in terms of learning, so this guy I know who for 4 years now he's been going to Daf Yomi, let me ask you, it would have been better if every morning for 45 minutes or an hour he actually sits with a chavrus or someone else and learns and maybe covers 5 or 6 lines, 10 lines a day, but he really would know it and he could read it over and he could repeat it and he could tell people what the sugya says. Daf Yomi is definitely interesting and valuable and all this, but I just don't think it's learning. I think it's valuable in other ways. For the Magid Shir, it's the highest form of learning, but for the average person who goes, I do not believe that someone listening to a daf, unless it's a Lagadita, can understand what's going on in 45 minutes. You need to think about. Gemara is not reading the Daily News or the New York Post. Every line of Gemara needs to be savored. You can't just read through it. And I feel that all this Daf Yomi, they're reading through it like they're reading through the newspaper, reading through a book of Gedolim stories. And that's not what learning is. So that if you're asking my opinion, that's my opinion. So I'll go to the stadium because I think it's to see the power of Orthodox Jewry, it's something to behold. It's a sight to be seen. On the other hand, I'm not impressed by people who tell me they do Daf Yomi. I'm very impressed by people, friends of mine, like Rabbi Dov Linzer and Rabbi Sessar Katz, that were Magide Shirim or who have completed the Daf Yomi. But for someone to tell me, or if someone on their own actually learns Daf Yomi, I'm impressed. But someone who goes to Daf Yomi, I somehow don't think that that's the best use of their time if they're really interested in learning. If they want to connect to Klal Yisrael, as Klal Yisrael does this amazing thing, fine, Daf Yomi's great. But I don't know. That's my sense, that it's not really learning in the traditional way of that learning has to be an active pursuit. It's not passive. The idea of learning, it's not listening to a sermon. It's not listening to someone else speak. Every individual has to, it's called yigia. You have to struggle over it. That's what it's about. So how could Daf Yomi, there's no struggle? That doesn't impress me very much. It's not my thing. Yisrael says, I read that the Cantonist decrees were a big problem when he was growing up, but he avoided that. Can you briefly describe what those decrees were? Sounds terrifying from what I have heard. I wrote about this on a Sfarim blog in my post on Jews and Communism. The Cantonist decrees were that children were taken. Not at random, because the government told the Jewish community to provide them with a certain amount of kids. So the Jewish community decided which kids were taken to the army for 25 years. That was pretty much the end of them. Although some did survive as Jews and were opened up shuls. The Jews pretty much, and the rabbis, the rich Jews and the rabbis with his own holy alliance, ended up choosing the poor kids to go. And this caused enormous tension in the Jewish world. It led to a rise of anti-clericalism because the rabbis were seen as corrupt in line with the rich people. We discussed this in the past, in particular with the Ritbaz, I think it was. Now I forget. Who was it? Oh, we discussed it with the, in the Chasam Sofer classes, I think it was, because I told you about, Ramishulam Igra, who, opposed, only taking the poor kids. That was not Cantonist, that was a different decrees. My best thing to say is to go to my Sfarim blog post, just plug in, Jews and, I think it's Jews and Communism. I give all the sources there and discuss it in great detail. I actually don't blame the rabbis because they're people too and they want their kids to be saved. Maybe the fairest thing would have been to have a lottery, but it was a terrible thing. whether Rav Meir Simcha, I don't think the dates work out. Maybe they work out. I have to check. In the biography, it is not meant that I've read, it doesn't mention, my recollection, anything about Cantonism there. I don't think so. Because I don't think the dates work out properly. No, the dates definitely don't work out properly. I just checked online. He's born in 1843. So if he's born in 1843, I'll tell you right now, the Cantonist decrees were... let's see, when were the Cantonist decrees abolished? They were abolished in 1856. So, yeah, 1853, 1856. He could have been in the last years because they took kids who were 12 and 13. So, in theory, he could have been one of the kids, but I've never heard that. Okay, everyone, thank you very much. And I hope, God willing, to see everyone next semester. Good night.